The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
This blood brothering between you, Prince Midalis, and you, Chieftain Bruinhelda, will be the first in over a decade. You are not to harm the Shaggoth, in no way, not even at the cost of your own life. Not that you could bring harm to the great beast anyway. Not even if you brought fine weapons in there with you. This is a test of your courage, not your warrior skills, and a test of your trust in each other. If either of you fails, then you both will surely die, and horribly. Are you prepared to begin?
What are you about, Elf? Are you going to tell me or not?
You take care, Bradwarden. On the South Road, I heard rumors of the Rosy Plague.
Oh, by the demons, you say?
I know not if there's any truth to those words. More likely, they were the utterances of a gossiping fool and nothing more. But I can ill afford to take the chance, any chance, of bringing the plague back to my people. Know that if the land becomes ill with plague, the Dwellalfar will secure our borders, and none will leave for many years. Farewell.
It is the plague! It is confirmed, my king! The Rosy Plague! What are we to do?
What can we do? Lock our doors fast and tight.
Oh, but where are you then? You've not been out of your walls in days! In weeks! Are you just to sit in there and let us all die then? Are you just to stand on your walls and shoot us dead if we come too close? And you're calling yourself the folk of God? But you're just a pack of scared dogs, you're!
Join with us before all the world is fallen into darkness. Help us put the church aright and thus end the misery of the plague.
You believe the plague to be a punishment from God?
On those who have forsaken the truth.
Absurd.
Obvious. I see it, and they see it. We know the truth, and we know the source, and no edicts from Father Abbot Agrangair will sway us from that path.
You risk the wrath of Father Abbot Agrangair and all the masters of St. Mirabel.
And you, Brother Glendonhawk, risk the wrath of Marcalo de Unaro. Which of us, then, do you believe in the worst situation?
You have gone mad.
As much has been said of many prophets. If you try to stop us, you may prove victorious, but I warn you that I will come for your throat first and foremost.
Experience the latest chapter of the Demon Wars saga in Graphic Audio. Don't miss Mortalis Part 2. Available now.
Cadet Vada.
Sir.
You are a disgrace to the service.
Sir?
Many, many people want your head on a pike. I'm going to see your resignation on my desk by 1500 hours this afternoon.
I, Kylara Evangeline Dominique Vada, hereby resign from the Academy for personal reasons.
Now we have to figure out what to do with
you. Dad, listen.
We're sending you out to the Rift with a ship going to salvage. You're taking the Glenys Jones to Lastway.
You're making me captain?
Courage, Kai. You've got what you need to start a good life. Go.
What if I can make enough in trade to buy Glenys and fix her up and own my own ship?
I need to talk to you.
What's up?
We have a contract to deliver a cargo of agricultural machinery to Belinta. What?
Kai. We wondered how long it'd take.
Trade and profit, right? Well, let's take a look at this contract you signed. We have to buy the goods up front?
Of course. I thought Sabine Prime. Sabine has several manufacturers of the kind of equipment they want.
But it's worth trying.
Mandatory repairs. We have to replace that sealed unit.
Secundus has threatened to blockade Prime.
Prime and Secundus are moving towards war this time.
Sabine's system is now cut off from regular communication with the rest of the universe.
We have a problem. Warships. Get us away from the station, Riel.
Glynis Jones, acknowledge.
Captain Vada, Glynis Jones.
Glynis Jones, this is the Mackenzie Military Assistance Corporation ship Victor. You will proceed alone down the escape passage to the lock. You will operate the lock for our boarding personnel. You will obey the orders of their commanding officer. If you disobey, your ship is toast. Got that?
You're Captain Vada?
Yes.
Start back up the passage. Tell him to sit down on the deck, hands on knees.
Where's Skeldon?
He was here a second ago.
Skeldon!
Pit to Victor. Send me a medic. Live, damn it.
From Elizabeth Moon, creator of the Serrano Legacy, a compelling new sci-fi series, Vata's War. Book 1, Trading in Danger, Part 1, in graphic audio.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Smoke Jensen, the Mountain Man, 13. Rage of the Mountain Man. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by James Lewis, Elizabeth Jernigan, Andy Clements, Eric Messner, Michael John Casey, David Korn, Tim Getter, Michael Glenn, Joe Brack, Tim Carlin, Terrence Aselford, Dylan Lynch, Casey Platt, Scott McCormick, Rand Casey, Ken Jackson, Johan Detweiler, Christopher Graybill, Richard Rowan, Chris Rowan, Jonathan Watkins, Laura Quinn Anderson, and Lily Beacon.
Slanting sunbeams cast a pink glow on the higher snow-capped peaks of the Rocky Mountains, which surrounded the lush valley that housed Sugarloaf, the ranch of Smoke Jensen. Smoke and his wife Sally had lived here most of their adult lives. They shared a fondness for the quiet, serenity, and wealth of resources of the fruitful basin. Yep, most of the time Smoke loved it. But the long winter had taken its toll, and he had a terrible case of cabin fever. He'd spent most of the day out riding the range and had just brought his handsome roan stallion back into the barn, where he was slipping the cinch strap to free the horse from the saddle.
Okay, Dandy. The nose bag comes next. One coffee box of oats.
Bobby Harris appeared. Pug nose in active motion over a scattering of freckles, mop of straw-colored hair sprouting wildly on a head still damp from the first spring sweat, the slender boy paused with hands held out to illustrate his exciting news.
Mr. Smoke, Lion let me brand two of the new calves this afternoon.
Well now, looks like you're about ready to draw a grown hand's pay.
Oh, I ain't that big yet.
You aren't that big yet.
Yeah, I aren't that big yet. That sounds funny.
That's because it isn't proper speech. I am not that big yet, is what you should say. Don't they teach you anything in the school in Big Rock?
They try, but it just goes over my head. I don't understand what they're talking about.
Then ask questions, boy. You'll never learn if you don't have it made clear to you.
Who needs all that educating stuff to work the sugar loaf?
You do. You'll not be on the sugar loaf all your life. A freight wagon full of opportunities outside this basin. Sally and I came here to find peace, and we did. But a young man needs his adventures before he turns to a more ordered way of life. Take my word for it.
Yes, sir. Like that time Sheriff Carson was telling me about when you shot up all those folks around Bury, Idaho?
What the hell is Monty doing telling tales like that to a kid? Well, never mind. The harm, if any, has already been done. I suppose you have a head full of wild tales about Smoke Jensen and Old Preacher.
Yes, sir. They just make me feel proud living here, being around you.
Well, time for you to take a dip in the horse trough to float off some of today's dust. Then you had best change clothes. You're eating at the main house tonight.
Am I? Oh, that's swell. Did Miss Sally bake any pies today?
Yep. Apricot, I think. Made it from some of them we dried last summer.
Mmm, I love apricot.
Seems to me you love anything so long as it's spelled P-I-E. Now get along and wash up.
Dinner went well. Lion Patterson, his vivacious wife Cynthia, and their two young children attended. Much to the delight of Bobby Harris and the Patterson youngsters, Sally Jensen prepared two pies. Smoke was secretly pleased, too. There was nothing he enjoyed more than Sally's pies and biscuits, crusty and brown on the outside and light and flaky and soft inside. Or just about anything she cooked, for that matter. Now, as Smoke lowered the wick in the last lamp in their living room, his mind turned to means to escape the tedium the long winter had engendered. It centered, as most of Smoke Jensen's thinking did, on the things in nature. Perhaps a 2 or 3 day fishing expedition far up the valley, beyond the area developed for the ranch. Or jaunt down to Denver, just him and Sally away and alone for a visit to the theater and visiting the livestock exchange and his old friend Silas Green. But such a thing would have to wait until the calves and new foal had all been branded. He had no way of knowing that Sally was envisioning something entirely different for him. Despite the difficulty of traversing the miles to Big Rock, Sally had maintained relatively regular communications with her family back in Keene, New Hampshire. High on her list of concerns was the state of her mother's health. Her father's last letter had brought the welcome news of considerable improvement. It had also contained intelligence regarding the top priority for Sally Jensen. She would have to broach the subject with Smoke at the earliest opportunity in order to have any hope of success. That would come over breakfast the next morning, she decided. She arranged herself in a suitably suggestive posture on the large, comfortable bed. Smoke's lighthearted smile bloomed into a wide grin of anticipation when he saw his wife's position.
I'll undress and, put out the light.
No, leave it burning. I like to watch you make love to me.
Later, Smoke Jensen lay beside his Sally in a deep restorative slumber. His keen senses were finely honed by Preacher's constant advice and example. But even Smoke almost missed the vague sound of three pops way off in the distance. He heard the huge wall of snow and ice as it broke away from the mountain above their stout log house. Smoke sat upright, fully alert. Gently, he shook Sally to rouse her.
Something's wrong.
What?
Something's happened to break off the snow wall above here. There's an avalanche. Put on your shoes. Wrap up in warm clothing. We have to get away from the house.
Will it hit the house?
I don't know, but we can't take the chance.
Smoke worked to pull on his trousers. His boots came next while Sally rushed to a large old armoire to find a robe and a heavy coat.
Smoke slid into a sheepskin coat and helped Sally into hers. They made their way to the front door. Outside, the stars still shone from above. Their glow turned the Colorado countryside to silver. Slowly, small puffs and swirls of windborne white began to obscure the sky. Smoke took Sally by one arm and directed her away at a right angle to the avalanche. Billowing ice crystals and fairy lace snowflakes pulled a black cloud over the heavens. Smoke chanced a quick glance to his left toward the descending wall of snow. It rolled and tumbled. Great gouts shot into the air. It flowed increasingly to each side, spread wider, and rushed toward the barns and bunkhouses to the right of the house. It sent small rounded clumps skittering across the ground toward Smoke and Sally on the left. The avalanche passed some 10 feet behind the Jensens. Smoke stood for a stunned moment before the realization of what he saw registered. The sky lightened as the haze of particles thinned. Sally turned a stricken face towards Smoke.
What happened to the bunkhouse? Where is it?
It's under there.
The men, did they get out?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Then they saw the movement within the snow and the dark silhouette of heads and the upper torsos of men emerging from the deep bank.
Wait a minute. Some of them made it out.
We have to do something.
By some unusual quirk, their house had been spared, yet the hands remained in terrible danger.
Go to the small tool shed. Bring shovels. I'm going to put these men to scooping out an escape route for the others.
The ranch hand known as Pearly stumbled towards Smoke and Sally.
Well, thank God there ain't many winders in that place. That snow slide knocked the building plumb off its foundation. If the walls had been weakened by a lot of winders, we'd all be goners.
How are the men?
All right, considering. There's bumps and bruises, a couple of broken arms, one broken leg, but the whole crew rode it out. Believe me, it was worse than the hurricane deck of a Mustang bronc. I cracked my head and wound up wedged under little Bobby's bunk.
What about the boy? Is he one of the hurt?
No, ma'am. Just a few scrapes. He ought to be along in a minute or two. The boys are handing out the ones hurt bad first.
Everyone froze, expressions showing their alarm. Smoke began automatically to tick off the seconds.
Could let go at any time. Sally, go for those shovels. Only stay in the shed. It's good and strong. I'll send men to get the tools.
What about the livestock that was in the corral that was over there?
The young hand's eyes fixed on a ripple-surfaced bed of snow. Not even a fence post showed above it.
We'll put men on it as fast as possible.
Half a dozen men stood in dazed dejection outside the short tunnel through the rubble of the avalanche. Some shivered, and one stockman cradled a limp, broken arm.
I want you boys to get started digging out the horses in that corral. Go to the tool shed for shovels. Be quick about it, but take it easy.
Another section of the snow overhang gave way and started racing down on the ranch headquarters. The men scattered, all except Smoke, who rushed to the opening in the mound to try to retrieve Bobby Harris.
Bobby!
The decaying shelf of snowpack remained in its place on a mountainside 1 second, and then the next it smacked Smoke in the back and drove him down the short tunnel into the engulfed bunkhouse. Smoke worked his hands under his chest and levered his torso upward. He found himself face to face with an anxious Bobby Harris.
Smoke! Smoke, you all right?
I'm fine. How about you?
Oh, we just got bounced around some.
Bobby indicated the half dozen ranch hands still inside.
Likely we'll get some more if we don't dig our way out of here fast.
Smoke made a quick study of the shambles inside the bunkhouse.
Can you get the door open?
No, it swings out, remember?
Smoke examined the hinge pins.
One of you take a knife and slip these pins. We'll pull the door down. It'll make a bigger tunnel to get us out.
Smoke searched the floor for what he wanted and came up with a tin dinner plate.
Once the door is out of the way, use your plates to dig in the snow. Move fast, but be sure to pack the upper surface as you go.
To set an example, Smoke Jensen was the first to hack away at the white wall outside the bunkhouse. He hurled the snow behind him into the room and burrowed at an upward angle. Space factors limited the tunnelers to 3.
Can I help?
I suppose so. When we break through, you're the smallest. So I want you to wiggle up to the surface and call for help.
Will there be anybody out there?
There had better be.
After 20 minutes more, Smoke began to hear the sounds of men digging from the other side of the snow wall, trying to get to them. With a final jab of his tin plate, Smoke broke through into the open.
There's somebody's hand.
Smoke slid back and wrapped big square hands around Bobby's waist. He hoisted the boy up over the windowsill.
Crawl out of there, Bobby!
A shower of icy flakes descended from Bobby Harris's boots into the face of Smoke Jensen. Then, welcome yellow light from a kerosene lantern spilled down through the doorway into the bunkhouse.
Y'all right down there!
Nothing that warm, dry clothes and a couple of shots of whiskey couldn't cure.
From the 10-foot-high, nearly floor-to-ceiling windows of the Cafe London, located on the top floor of the Windsor Hotel in Denver, one could not tell that the high lonesome still languished in the final throes of the most severe winter on record. Golden sunlight slanted warmly into the room. Mid-afternoon traffic flowed with its usual jumble past the five-story edifice, designed like Windsor Castle in England. A favorite must-do stop for the Europeans visiting the West, the Windsor also catered to the discriminating tastes of the wealthier, more traveled Easterners, such as the two men seated at the table in a corner turret window. Phineas Lathrop had a striking appearance. He was in his early 50s, and the widow's peak of his lush hair not the slightest sprinkling of gray. What accentuated his remarkable good looks were two large streaks of white hair at his temples, shaped like the wings of a bird. He peered at his associate down a long nose through a pince-nez perched near the slightly bulbous tip.
Well, Arnold, this is a far cry from Boston, I dare say.
Yes, it certainly is that.
A bit of a dandy, Arnold Cabot wore the latest fashion, his vest as bright as the plumage of a scarlet tanager. A large puffy silk cravat peaked from the V-neckline, set off by a sea of snowy white boiled and starched shirt. Junior to Phineas Lathrop by some 7 years, he was the youngest of the five-man consortium established to engender Phineas Lathrop's grand project.
What was so urgent that it brought you so far away from your bully boys down on the docks?
Such colorful reference to the men of his brotherhood of longshoremen caused Arnold Cabot to wince.
There's a problem with our associates in New York. They are reluctant to commit the money. At least until our difficulties are resolved with that uncouth lout to the north of here.
Ah, I see. Having the available funds is always a problem. However, we should be hearing about that other matter any day now. I dispatched my most trustworthy subordinate to deal with it.
What do you mean, deal with?
You'll know when Wade Tanner returns from the high mountains. I left word at the desk that we would be here in the event he gets back today.
Our friends in New York insist on immediate action. They will not release a penny until they know the obstacle keeping us from achieving our goal has been removed.
You're talking like a bloody accountant, Arnold. I'm in charge in the West, and I'll decide when funds are to be released for the progress of the enterprise. If those penurious bastards in New York don't like that, they can be cut out altogether.
We need their money, Phineas, desperately. That's why I came here to appeal to you to return with me and convince them yourself. You convinced them once. I know you can talk open their pocketbooks now that we're in the clutch.
Aha! So that's what this excursion into the Rockies is all about. Are things really so desperate?
Yes, they are. You should know that walk out on the docks is sucking us dry. We have to pay Sean O'Boyle and his longshoremen their pittance every week in order to keep them out. We can break the backs of the shipping companies and then move in and take over. But we must have the cash to do it, all of it. No bank would lend the money to buy a shipping company plagued by a wildcat walkout. And we can hardly confide in the bankers that we're responsible for the strike. So, to cover all of that and continue to finance your acquisitions out here, we need the New York people. You, more than anyone else, have the power to persuade them.
Suddenly,
Phineas Lathrop brightened as he caught sight of a most unlikely patron striding towards their table.
Ah, sit down, Wade.
Always a pleasure to see you, Mr. Lathrop. And how are you, sir?
The man's cultured, courteous tone belied his scruffy appearance, and the menace of a brace of Smith & Wesson American 44s slung low on his hips.
Forgive my manners. This is an associate from back east, Arnold Cabot. Wade Tanner, my chief enforcer, shall we say. You have good news for me, Wade?
A pleasure to make your acquaintance, Mr. Cabot. Yes, Mr. Lathrop. That dynamite works splendidly. You should have no difficulty obtaining the desired property now. And the others, without a rallying figure, should capitulate readily.
Arnold Cabot blinked at this cultured speech pouring from under the large, wide nose past the rabbity teeth that heightened a certain rodent-like appearance. Tanner looked the part of the lowliest of common gunmen, but he talked like a gentleman. If only his boastful preamble proved true, their troubles would be over.
You are absolutely sure of that?
Oh, yes, sir. Smoke Jensen is now just a memory.
For Sally Jensen, that avalanche was the final straw. She was not one to make issues out of frivolous discomforts, but the snowslide that had nearly claimed the life of her husband and many of his workers hardened Sally's determination to escape the rigors of the past winter. Sally put down a skillet now to peer through the rear window and up the face of the mountain that, to her way of thinking, had betrayed him. Was that a blackened smudge she saw against the sparkling white of the snow ledge? Her eyes watered at the brightness and strain. There appeared to be three dark spots.
Kirby, we simply have to get out of here.
That got Smoke's immediate reaction. She never called him by his given name unless a situation had reached the critical level.
I've been thinking along those lines myself.
Well, I'm glad, because I'm convinced we need to get as far away from these mountains and that dreadful snow as possible.
Meaning where?
New Hampshire. My father's place. It's been years since I've spent more than a day or two there. Longer still since you've visited. He would be so pleased, and so would Mother. In his last letter, Father grew almost poetic when he described the coming of spring in the Green Mountains.
I was thinking of New Orleans.
Smoke hoped to distract Sally from her temporary madness by offering a trip to her favorite city. Sally had taken a call in New Orleans, the most civilized town in America.
That would be very nice, dear. But Father has been growing more earnest in his urging for us to pay a visit. His last letter said he had a marvelous diversion in mind for you.
You are all the diversion I need. We could rent a room in that big old house on Basin Street, and I could have you all to myself.
Ooh, that's tempting. But Father would be so disappointed. I've all but agreed, needing only to confer with you, of course.
All right. I suppose we can spare a couple of weeks to visit your father and mother. But I'm holding out for at least a week in New Orleans.
Well, that's wonderful. Only, it's so extravagant.
What's wrong with that? We can afford it. When do you want to go?
Right now, right away. I mean, right after the livestock have been rescued.
I'll ride into Big Rock this afternoon to telegraph John about our intended arrival, and also to get the tickets for the train.
Oh, you are a darling. I knew you would say yes.
Big Rock, Colorado had grown considerably over the years since Smoke Jensen had first ridden into town. The main street had lengthened to three blocks of businesses, with an additional residential block at the north and south ends. Cross streets featured shops at least to the alley, with the central intersection extending the commercial area a full block east and west. Smoke concluded his business at the railroad depot by 4 p.m. He decided on paying a call on Sheriff Monty Carson. He found him in his favorite saloon, the Silver Dollar, at the bar. Monty liked his beer, as the slight rounding and his thickening of his middle gave testimony. One elbow resting on the mahogany, Monte Carson was turned three quarters away from the array of bottles on the back bar. His left hand held a large bowl-like schooner, its contents lowered by half. A smile lighted his face when he made out the features of Smoke Jensen.
Now, ain't you a sight? What brings you to town?
Cabin fever.
Let's go sit down.
They took a table off to one side. Settled in, the conversation ran to small talk until Smoke mentioned the avalanche of the previous night. Carson asked for details, and he got them. He shook his head wonderingly as Smoke recounted the initial downfall of winter-packed snow. He literally gaped when Smoke told of the second slide.
Did you lose many horses?
Only one had to be put down, broken leg. The others in the corral got bruised up by ice chunks and got a right good chill.
Smoke looked up as five youthful drifters entered the saloon. They surrounded a table and glowered menacingly at the sole occupant until he rose and hastily departed. The apparent leader plunked into the vacated captain's chair and propped his boot heels on the scarred, water-ringed tabletop.
The bartender, get your ass over here and bring us a bottle.
Looks like you've inherited someone else's troubles.
I'd say we have a problem.
We? Who's we? You got a chipmunk in your pocket?
You're here. You're packing iron. It's too far for me to go get a deputy.
You're slowing down in your old age, Monty.
I'm not that much older than you, Smoke.
Hey, what you old farts come in here for, to take a nap? And what's keeping our whiskey, you bag of guts?
Tortoise-like, Opie Quinn's head appeared to pop down into the protection of his rising shoulders. Without a word, he pointed to a big, bold sign.
We reserve the right to refuse service to anyone. What? You think you're too good to serve us? Y'all think you're too good to drink with us? Well, just who do you think this is sitting here? I'm Red Tyrell. That's right, Red Tyrell. The man who gunned down three Texas Rangers in a fair fight all at once.
Bullshit.
Bullshit, is it? Who's looking for an early trip to the Boneyard? Which one of you gutless wonders said that? Come on, fess up! We're reasonable boys. We're in the mood for some whoop-de-doo being cooped up all winter, so we're inclined to go easy, leaving y'all breathing with all your teeth.
You're inclined to be locked in a jail cell more likely.
You do enjoy baiting smart-ass kids, don't you, Monty?
Oh, you two are pushing it.
Pardon me if I'm under-impressed.
If you gentlemen will excuse me, I have to visit the outhouse.
With slow, deliberate insolence, Smoke turned his back on the quarrelsome punks and strode to the rear door.
You're the one that said bullshit, ain't you? Now you're gonna have to back that up with iron.
Smoke stopped walking, and Monty decided that was enough. He flipped the lapel of his black coat away from his vest, revealing the five-pointed star he wore there. He snapped to his boots and advanced on the agitator.
That'll be enough of that. Cool off or spend a night in our jail.
Suddenly, one of the men moved with the liquid speed and silence of a snake. He came up behind Monty Carson and laid the 7-inch barrel of his Colt Peacemaker alongside Monty's head, an inch above his right ear.
Now you've done a very unwise thing, assaulting a peace officer, especially one who's my friend. That can get you in some real trouble.
Oh, is that right? And what do you think killing Texas Rangers could get us?
Dead. Exactly like you'll all be if you don't pick up my friend, the sheriff, clean the sawdust off of him, and accompany me to the jail.
By God, that does it. Spread out, boys. Fill your hand, you bastard.
Red Tyrell and his four juvenile hard cases opened out into positions which gave them each a clear field of fire at Smoke Jensen. Trouble was, they were too stupid to realize that it also gave Smoke an open line on each of them. Red alone still stood, and he was shaking in his boots.
No, don't! Oh God, don't shoot me!
Give me one good reason why I shouldn't.
Monty started to come too.
Anything I can do to help, Smoke?
Smoke? You ain't... You can't be. Tell me you ain't Smoke Jensen.
That's who he is, all right.
Oh my god!
Whoop, smoke. I think this little boy done dirtied his drawers.
A warm day had melted away much of the scattered snow of the avalanche. The hands had spread out across the Sugarloaf during the afternoon to tend to various duties, the foremost being fence mending. Smoke had not yet returned from Big Rock, although that didn't distress Sally Jensen. She spoke now in her parlor with a smooth-talking stranger who had just introduced himself as Buford Early. Sally had taken an immediate dislike to Buford. A dapper dresser, he impressed her as a bit foppish. An overabundant amount of pomade slicked back his hair, made darker by its presence. Sally figured it was probably dark brown rather than jet black when it was free of the goop. His business suit had not a trace of trail dust due to the long white linen duster he had removed the moment he dismounted, uninvited. His high-buttoned shoes gleamed like patent leather.
Jew, I have the honor of speaking to the widow of Smoke Jensen.
I am Mrs. Sally Jensen. There is no widow here.
I've been given to understand otherwise. I have been authorized by my principals to make a handsome offer for the Sugarloaf, Widow Jensen.
Thank you. No, Mr. Early, the Sugarloaf is not for sale.
This is a lonesome, I might even say, dangerous country for a woman trying to go it alone, Widow Jensen.
I just told you, I am not a widow. My husband is alive and well and should be returning from Big Rock at any minute now.
Ah, my. I understand. The first stage of grief is always denial. Seriously, you must come to grips with the facts and plan intelligently for your future. Consider what might happen if a gang of rustlers struck.
Since we keep only 10 head of cattle and 2 milk cows, I don't think rustlers would be in the least interested in the Sugarloaf. Prize horses are what we raise, and they are all marked on the inside of the lower lip in a manner that cannot be altered. So stealing them would be fruitless.
Come now, a young widow like yourself must face the facts. My offer is really quite generous.
No, my husband is not dead, and the Sugarloaf is not for sale.
Face reality!
Mr. Early, what part of no don't you understand?
I know for a fact that Smoke Jensen died in an avalanche just last night. Here on this ranch, I must caution you, Widow Jensen. You certainly can't believe that some mere woman can hold out against my principles. They are determined men. With your husband so recently deceased, I can understand a certain hesitancy to act with reason, but one must strike while the iron is hot.
Are you threatening me, Mr. Early?
I'm trying to get you to see reason. This is a difficult time, of course, but such a generous offer won't come around again.
My goodness, is that so? From what you said a moment ago, I got the impression you intended to keep pestering me until I did what you wanted, no matter how often you had to come back.
Early reached into the inside pocket of his coat as he advanced on Sally across the large oval oriental rug.
I have the papers right here. I'm going to put them on that desk, and you are going to sign them!
What is it you have in mind for her to sign?
Hello, Smoke.
Jensen?
Who is this tinhorn?
His name is Buford Early. He came to make an offer on the Sugarloaf to the widow Jensen. I tried to tell him, but he wouldn't listen. Mr. Early, let me introduce Mr. Smoke Jensen.
There appears to have been some mistake.
Reports of my death are greatly exaggerated. I'd be interested in hearing how and from who you got this mistaken information.
Well, now that is, I mean to say, my principals prefer to remain anonymous.
Smoke Jensen wound thick, hard fingers into the blossom of Early's cravat and yanked the small man. Early hung on tiptoes from the silk stock around his neck.
I asked you nicely. I could do it another way. Who are you working for?
They will be terribly upset if I breach their confidence.
Not nearly so much as I am right now.
If I provide you that information, you will see to it that I do not suffer as the consequence.
What I do with the names is no concern of yours. And what happens to you is none of mine.
Oh, my! Oh, dear! I truly regret this unfortunate interruption.
I'm sure you do. Now, the names.
My clients are Mr. Ambruster and Cooper Smith of Denver.
Thank you. Being straightforward always makes one feel better, don't you agree? Now, I'm going to sit you down, and you're going to tell me how you intended to get my wife to sign those papers.
Smoke set him down and Early shrugged to ease the tension in his neck and shoulders.
Well, after all, she is a mere slip of a woman. I felt that the force of my person and the reasonableness of my argument would eventually persuade her.
Just a mere slip of a woman, huh? Consider yourself lucky I came back when I did. Otherwise, Sally, that mere slip of a woman, may have punched your ticket to the Monument Garden. Together we fought Indians, rustlers, and outlaws, intent on carving a big chunk out of our high lonesome for more years than I care to count. We've even kicked the hell out of more than our fair share of two-bit tinhorn upstarts like you. So far, we haven't gone soft. We haven't even slowed down much. So take word back to Armbruster and Cooper Smith, if those are their real names. The Sugarloaf is not for sale and never will be, so long as Sally or I am alive. And I don't look for our children to sell it either.
This isn't the end of this!
Buford Early made a hasty departure.
That was some speech. I've never heard you string so many words together in all the years we've been married.
Well, that oily snake touched on something close to my heart, and he upset you. Well, you'll be happy to know that we're due to leave in 2 days. We'll take the day coach to Denver, then a compartment on a private car all the way to Chicago.
That's marvelous. How did it happen?
Courtesy of a grateful Colonel Joshua Drew, president of the Denver and Rio Grande. You'll recall I scouted for him some years back on a breakthrough route in the Rockies. Well, when Nate at the depot telegraphed our reservations to Denver, Colonel Drew learned of it and made arrangements. Nate's boy brought me word while I was visiting with Monte Carson.
2 days? Smoke! How can I possibly pack everything in such a short time?
Phineas Lathrop sat fuming in the parlor of his suite in the Windsor Hotel in Denver. He glared heatedly at Buford Early.
You're positive. It couldn't be just some man in her life.
He wore 2 guns, one of them in a gunfight, a cross-draw. He picked me up off the floor without even a sign of effort. It was Smoke Jensen, all right? He all but told me that if I showed my face around there again, he'd kill me. I believed him.
I'm sure you did. Wade Tanner assured me that the Avalanche accounted for Jensen. We missed him. We'll have to try again. Get out of here. I have plans to make. Send in Wade Tanner.
Hey, Tanner.
Mr. Lathrop?
You're wrong about Smoke Jensen. Early locked horns with him at the Sugarloaf. He's still alive, Tanner. I want you to put men to changing that right
away. You want me to go with him, Mr.
Lathrop? No. I have something else in mind for you. I'm leaving this afternoon for back east. There's much to be done in Boston and New York. I want you to take the rest of your men and start obtaining the smaller holdings in the high mountains. Proceed as though Jensen was no longer alive and everyone knew about it.
What if they know better and won't sell?
Then deal with the widows.
Although well accustomed to train travel, Sally Jensen had never seen anything quite so opulent as Colonel Drew's private coach. They encountered a narrow passageway past the lavatory, storage pantry, and kitchen. A narrow, cell-like space provided sleeping accommodations for the cook, his helper, and the butler. Next came the doors to 4 sleeping compartments. Beyond that, the dining room, which opened out to full width, its forward and rear walls covered with crystal mirrors and mahogany frames. A cut crystal chandelier with Tiffany reflector hung over a large oval cherrywood table. Matching chairs with plush seat cushions provided seating for 8. Graceful columns of polished mahogany formed an archway into the sitting room. Overhead, pressed tin ceiling covers depicted scenes from mythology, the details picked out in gold foil. Comfortable wing chairs, a love seat, and a Chesterfield sat in casual disarray among low tables and smoking stands in the sitting room. A small bar graced the wall that screened the dining room. Stained glass bordered the windows in a domed cupola that admitted light.
It's so beautiful.
I'd buy you diamonds if you had anywhere to wear them.
Oh, Pooh, I already have diamonds. Do you think we might be able to afford one of these?
Well, we never go somewhere often enough to make it practical. And I, for one, don't find that unappealing.
Stick in the mud.
Suddenly, the door to the observation platform at the rear opened. A gangly young man stood in the opening. He awkwardly held an alligator skin glad stone bag. Behind him stood an attractive young lady.
Excuse me, I think you have the wrong car.
Maybe it's you who are in the wrong place.
This is Colonel Joshua Drew's private car. I'm his son-in-law, his new son-in-law. We're on our honeymoon.
Smoke removed his Montana Peak Stetson. He studied the callow young man and wondered how in the hell the colonel had ever consented to allow his younger and most precious daughter to marry this one. Had the invitation to use the private car been an error? Smoke removed the tickets from his inside coat pocket, accidentally revealing the cartridge belt and the butt of his gunfighter-rigged cross-draw .45. Immediately, the youthful male newlywed washed pale white and dropped the bag. He clutched at the arm of the girl who now stood beside him.
Watch out, Pris. This ruffian has a gun.
Priscilla Drew looked beyond her husband, and her efforts at recollection moved fluidly across her face.
Why, I know you. You're Mr. Jensen. You work for my father. You laid the course for the DNRG through the high passes of the Rockies.
That's correct. But I don't recall you, Miss... Mrs.
Small wonder, Mr. Jensen. I was only a child at the time.
The one who loved horses more than locomotives, am I right? That lovely blonde hair gives you away. You wore it in sausage curls then, too, didn't you?
Oh, I would have just died of ecstasy if I had known you noticed me then. Thomas, it skipped my mind, what with everything that went on before and after our wedding. Daddy did say that we would be sharing the car with a good friend of his and his wife. This must be them. Mr. Smoke Jensen, my husband, Thomas Henning. I'm Mrs. Henning now.
How do you do?
Fine, thank you. I was about to show you our tickets and travel itinerary. Your father's most generous, Mrs. Henning. We have use of the car all the way to Boston.
Just like him. Send along a chaperone on our honeymoon.
May I present my wife, Sally Reynolds Jensen.
Thomas cocked an eyebrow.
Oh? Would that be the New Hampshire Reynoldses? Banking, the stock market, diversified investments?
The same.
Well, I must say, I had no idea that rough-edged Westerners even knew anyone from the distinguished families, let alone that one had married into a family so acceptable as the Reynoldses.
I think you have it wrong, boy. Sally married me. I didn't marry into any family.
Please, Thomas, don't be such a snob. You've had a problem with that since you came to Denver.
But he's so common.
Thomas! One doesn't talk to people out here like that.
Not unless one is prepared to back it up.
Sir, I am not armed. I abhor firearms.
Which is what is keeping you alive right now. Folks, this is rapidly going nowhere. Relax, Mr. Henning. Sally always tells me my bark is worse than my bite. Since we're going to be together in this car for... how long?
We're leaving the train at Kansas City to take a riverboat to New Orleans.
Smoke turned to Sally.
That's where we should be going instead of on to the East Coast. Since we're going to be together in this car for at least 3 days, we might as well make peace and get along as well as we can.
Call me Pris.
I'm Sally.
Thomas, if you please.
Smoke.
Do you have more luggage?
Jenkins has taken care of it. It should be in our compartment.
As though summoned by name, the butler Jenkins appeared from the door to one compartment.
Miss Priscilla, Mr. Thomas, I have taken the liberty of giving you the second compartment. That way there will be no one to either side of you. Mr. Jensen, yours will be the one at this end, number 4.
Thank Thank you, Jenkins. If you will excuse us, we will go change into something more suitable for travel.
There will be champagne and hors d'oeuvres in the parlor section in 1 hour.
That will be fine.
Needn't hurry on our account.
Smoke and Sally entered their compartment and found it just as opulent as the rest of the car. Wood-paneled walls with plush red-flocked wallpaper interspersed gave a rich glow to the room. All the brasswork had been highly polished. A double set of facing seats would fold down into one bed, the other an overhead swing-away model. Sally examined them and then grinned impishly up at her husband.
I wonder how the newlyweds will handle this arrangement.
Sally, you shock me. I never dreamed you could harbor such nasty thoughts. But for that matter, how are we going to get around it?
Oh, we'll manage.
Once the train had slowed down through the heart of Denver and beyond its suburbs, it was literally all downhill to Ellsworth. The journey across the rolling prairie would take the rest of the day and much of the next afternoon to complete. Although named the Daylight Express, numerous water and coal stops would eat into the time on the 396-mile journey. Also, there would be passenger stops at Lyman and Stratton in Colorado and at Goodland and Fort Hays in Kansas. With that in mind, Smoke and Sally Jensen returned to the parlor section of the private car shortly before the hour had passed. Before the happy newlywed couple put in an appearance, the conductor entered the car and came to Smoke.
Mr. Jensen, you'll pardon me for being blunt, sir. As it is, I happened to notice you had boarded the train armed. Sure, and that's a comfort to me.
Why is that?
Because I'm traveling armed this trip myself. The name's Liam Quincannon, and though it is true I work for the Santa Fe, Colonel Drew had a quick word with me when we made arrangements for his car to be placed on the Daylight. The good Colonel asked that I keep a protective eye on his daughter, you see.
Smoke saw only too well. He began to suspect that Colonel Drew's generosity in offering them his private car and then installing the newlyweds might be tempered by a desire to have further protection for his dearest daughter. The old man had spoiled her outrageously whenever she had visited the railhead during construction. Well, that was fine with him, Smoke decided, so long as everything went well. Somehow, though, Smoke had the gut feeling that something would come along to see that it did not go well. Later, Smoke and Sally Jensen sat with Thomas and Priscilla Henning and partook of a late breakfast. Coffee sloshed over the gold-filled rims of delicate china cups and stained the linen tablecloth. Thomas nearly impaled his cheek with a fork.
What in heaven's name?
Probably something on the tracks.
Smoke cut his eyes to the window opposite his place at the table.
From what I can see, it's a two-legged something.
Smoke came to his boots and started toward the passageway that led past the compartments and kitchen. Sally sent an understanding look after him, then rose in a composed manner.
Come, Pris. I think it is wise if you and Thomas go to your compartment. Lock the door after you.
Why? What is it, Sally?
Perhaps nothing. But Smoke isn't often mistaken. It could be trouble.
Oh, what sort of trouble?
Train robbers.
Smoke stepped onto the vestibule at the same time as Liam Quincannon. The worried expression on the man's face made Smoke's question unnecessary.
Sure, I'm in a devil of a spot. I've me duty to the passengers on the railroad, but there's...
He nodded toward the private car.
We'll take care of them first. Reassure them.
Fine thinking, bucko.
Inside the car, Smoke and Liam walked along the passageway until they came upon Sally and the Hennings.
We're going to have to do something about breaking up this robbery. Thomas, I suggest you two lock yourselves in your compartment and pull down the window blind.
I've tried to get them to hurry and do that, Smoke.
If you're not use good sense, then I must stay to protect the Colonel's daughter.
Sally dug into her pearl-studded clutch purse.
It's all right. I can do that. I have my Colt Lightning.
Thomas's eyes went wide as he stared at the compact parrot-billed grips of the .38 revolver.
I thought I made myself clear. I despise nasty firearms.
If you won't use one, then I suppose I can protect you, too.
Get them into the room quickly, Sally. We're gonna go cause some grief for those train robbers.
Smoke and Liam took the door opposite the side of the train where the robbers sat their mounts in silent contemplation. They stepped out onto the vestibule.
I'll head for the cab. They always put one or two in there to watch the engineer.
Good idea. I'll take the top of the cars.
You could get trapped there, Mr. Jensen.
It's smoke to you, Liam. And I don't think so. I'll have the advantage of surprise and try to keep it.
Saints above! You're Smoke Jensen, the gunfighter and mountain man!
We'll talk about it later. I'll give you time to reach the locomotive. Don't shoot anyone until I open up. Better chance they won't know you've taken out their men that way.
Oh, you're a crafty one, I'll say that.
Quincannon started along the right-of-way, bent below the thick layer of ballast that would mask his movements. Smoke climbed to the roof of the Pullman next to Drew's private car. Belly down on the catwalk, he edged forward and then to his right off the boards. When he neared the edge, he raised his head slightly to take in the scene below. Smoke immediately saw half a dozen of the masked holdup men. Three men quickly fell from their saddles. Uncertain as to where the shots had come from, the survivors looked around in confusion.
Up there!
Smoke was in no immediate danger because he'd quickly moved as soon as he had fired his first shot. The slugs flew over Smoke's head as he hugged the offside of the car below the catwalk. He hand-walked his way back to his starting place, climbed down and went to the ground in the direction Liam had taken. A quick glance forward gave him sight of an all-clear signal from Liam Quincannon in the cab. Smoke went beyond the point of his first encounter with the bandits and crawled under a car. Smoke took a quick peek beyond one shiny steel disc. The trio he had left unharmed had been joined by five more. They spread out almost on top of him. The explosion signaled the forced entry of the express car. That drew the attention of all the hard cases forward, and Smoke took full advantage. Again, Smoke disappeared before being spotted. Seated with his back against the ballast gravel, Smoke reloaded his .45 while he reviewed the positions of his enemy. Six across the track from him, he'd counted seven more in a cluster near the chair cars. 10, perhaps a dozen, had gathered outside the express car before the blast. Smoke chose to climb in order to add to the confusion of the bandits. On the top of the rear chair car now, Smoke wriggled on his belly to the near edge and looked down on a group of empty saddles, the reins of the horses that wore him held by a single outlaw. The man went down and the nervous horses set off at a fast run.
Oh, shit! The horses!
They go the horses!
Although he had easy targets, Smoke held his fire, and so did Liam. Smoke Jensen climbed from the rooftop and started toward the express car. Liam showed himself in the doorway to the cab and swung onto the rungs that gave access to the ground. He joined Smoke outside the combination mail and strongbox car. A masked man appeared in the blast-shredded doorway. He looked forward, then to the rear, finally downward. His eyes widened, showing a lot of white when he peered into the muzzle of the .45 Frontier in Smoke Jensen's hand.
Ain't nothing going right in this damn job from the very beginning.
Buck Waldron led the way out of the last chair car and onto the vestibule between it and the first Pullman. So far, they had taken only 100 or so in cash and some trinkets. If Travis didn't hit a bonanza in the express car, they might as well have stayed in Hayes and gotten drunk.
Okay, Dorn, you go through there. Now watch for some fool playing hero.
Dorn entered the sleeping car ahead of his boss, a fat Smith American 44 in his left hand.
Ah, shit! Well, that came from the express car. Come on, Dorn, we gotta check it out.
Slowly, the outlaws worked their way down the aisle, totally unaware of what awaited them in the car behind this one. Smoke Jensen approached the gaping hole where the door to the express car had once been. Behind him, Liam Quincannon faced outward, watching for the return of any of the robbers out chasing their horses. With Colt leading the way, Smoke peeked his head around the side.
You shouldn't have missed.
Smoke ducked back around the corner.
Oh, my God! I'm hit, Travis!
Shut up! Keep down!
How many of us out there?
I don't know.
Enough.
You a railroad detective?
Nope, only a passenger.
Well, this ain't your money! Why are you doing the Santa Fe any favors?
I got bored back in that private car.
thought I'd mix in and put some zest in my life.
Who are you anyway?
Name's Jensen. Smoke Jensen.
Oh, sweet Jesus! I don't need this! I surely don't need to face off with Smoke, by God, Jensen!
You can always leave, without the take from the safe, of course.
Yeah. Jensen, you still packing a badge?
I am.
It won't do you any good here in Kansas.
Deputy United States Marshal. I reckon it works here as good as in Colorado.
Oh, hell, Jensen! Oh, we're as good as goners as it is. We might as well come out.
You do that. I'll be waiting.
Travis motioned to the two unwounded men with him that he wanted them ready. They nodded silently, unseen by Smoke Jensen. Then, Travis rose from behind the mail sorting frame and rushed the door.
I'm gonna kill you, you bastard!
Smoke nailed Travis. Travis's two underlings rushed past. From behind Smoke, Quinn Cannon raised his revolver.
Oh, shit! I ain't armed! I'm coming out! I crawl on my belly!
Good enough. Make it slow. Liam, we'll secure this one and head for the train. You can be sure there's a few of them looting the passengers.
Right you are, Smoke. My God, there's some of them coming back.
Six of the Waldron gang had now recovered their horses and rode at a gallop back to the train. Smoke and Liam leveled their pistols at the oncoming men.
We'd better find out where the rest are on the train.
Aye, I'll tell the engineer to put her in reverse once we get aboard. That should give us a hair's edge on the spalpeens.
Smoke trotted along the stalled cars toward the last in line. Liam joined him and the engine came to life. Smoke mounted the steps to the last Pullman. Liam Quincannon came behind and paused long enough to give the hand signal to go full reverse. Wheels turned smoothly in the trucks and slowly the train rolled backward. Inside the Pullman, anxious faces greeted Smoke with new apprehension.
Please, we've already been robbed. We've nothing more to give you.
Then the woman saw Liam Quincannon over Smoke Jensen's shoulder and her jaw sagged.
Oh, I'm so sorry. We thought you were more of them. They went there.
The woman pointed a finger toward the rear door.
What do you think, Liam?
No sense in blundering right into them, says I.
Agreed. I think I'll take to the rooftops again. You can back me up from the vestibule once it's cleared.
Meanwhile, Buck Waldron read into the initials inscribed above the door the private car.
Denver and Rio Grande. Oh, well, boys, I wonder if that old fart himself is in there. They're hauling old Colonel Drew along as a courtesy. That's so we can make a pass of more money selling his carcass back to his railroad. Damn it. Door's locked. Open up in there! You hear me? Open up right now!
Inside, a thoroughly demoralized Thomas Henning wrung his hands and stared along the passageway toward the front of the car.
God damn it! Open this door!
Well, what do you propose to do?
Exactly what Smoke said to do. We stay here, safe behind that door. Although it is too late for you to lock yourselves in your compartment, they'd see you going there and it wouldn't buy us anything.
Then I think the reasonable thing to do is open up and let them in before they get any angrier.
Thomas, I don't know how it's done where you came from, but out here, when a person lies down and rolls on his back, he's likely to get kicked in the belly.
Oh, that's crudely put, but colorful. What has it to do with our present situation?
Everything.
Open up or we'll kill everyone in there!
Priscilla clutched at her husband's trembling arm.
Do they mean it?
Possibly. All the more reason we delay them as long as possible. It wasn't any outlaw started up the train. Smoke will be here soon.
Oh, this won't do us any good.
Thomas broke free of his wife then and scurried along the passageway toward the door.
Thomas! Oh, Lord, Pris, come on into the parlor. We have some planning to do and some play acting.
All right.
Thomas reached the door.
Get out of the way, you pimply face nothing!
Five hard-faced, scowling outlaws advanced along the narrow corridor toward where the women waited in the parlor section. The one in the lead roughly shoved Thomas along ahead of himself.
Well, now, what do we have here?
Who are you?
More to the point, sister, who are you?
Well, I'm Sally, Miss Priscilla's maid.
Pleased to make your acquaintance, Sally. This Miss Priscilla?
That's all right, Sally. I can answer for myself. I am Priscilla Hennick. That is my husband you were shoving around, you lout. What have you done to him?
I didn't like the way he took his sweet time opening the door, so I gave him a lesson in manners.
You brute!
No, Miss Priscilla, calm down. You'll only get yourself hurt.
You got some smarts there, Sally.
You still haven't told us your names. With those masks on, we don't know a thing about you.
You don't, huh? Well, my name's Buck Waldron. And this here's part of my gang. We rob trains.
Well, how odd. Why do you rob trains?
Because that's where the money is.
I'm sure it takes men of abounding courage to menace two helpless women.
Sally, darling, you don't talk like a maid. You sound more like someone used to giving a maid orders.
Oh, well, I suppose that after a number of years listening to my mistress's orders, I've taken some of her ways of speaking.
Well, there's something rotten about people who have servants. Oh, enough of this. Tell us where the valuables are kept and we can help ourselves.
Oh, there's nothing, really.
Sally moved casually to the love seat where she had concealed her .38 Colt in the cushion.
People like your mistress don't travel without a lot of fussy stuff. That much I know. So, Sally gal, be real good and tell us.
Sally held her breath as she sank into the cushion.
Anything you might want can be found in their compartment.
Sally?
Number 4.
Dorn, go get it.
I got something else in mind, Buck. Here's a tasty young thing that's just begging to be loved proper. Stands to reason this sorry excuse of a husband can't satisfy her.
You figure you can?
Oh, I know I can. Give me a chance, and I'll prove it.
All right. Lovell, you fetch the jewels and cash. Go ahead, Dorn, have your try.
No!
Thomas leaped to his feet and rushed at the one called Dorn. The huge Dorn laid him out with one punch. Dorn turned away from Thomas and started for Priscilla. Then his eyes shifted to Sally as well.
I think I'll try me a helping a sweet little Sally here, too.